is a poem about the first transistor radio I ever owned back in the late 1950s. It's called First Radio. A plastic transistor from Japan, aqua with black vinyl straps, some chrome trim, an ear-sized speaker, dials like nails, perched in the pocket as a pack of cigarettes, its hidden heart pulsing over mine.
Poet Michael McPhee. His new book is a collection of the work of 15 contemporary North Carolina poets. Welcome to Soundings, a magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. The Tar Heel State has long enjoyed a national reputation for fiction that almost rivals the fame of its basketball teams. But recently, numerous awards have gone to North Carolina poets. So it was a natural for poet and teacher Michael McPhee to assemble a collection featuring the work of 15 of North Carolina's leading versifiers. The result is entitled The Language They Speak Is Things to Eat. Michael McPhee will be here in just a moment to explain that title, read from his anthology, and talk about the poets he included. First, we begin with a reading by one of them. Here's Betty Adcock with a poem entitled Southbound.
You can go back in a clap of blue metal, tracked by stewardesses with drinks and virginal masks. These will work whether you breathe or not, and this is the first part. The way is farther, into thin roads that sway with the country. Through the shine of a rented car, the red towns rise and crumble, leaving faces stuck to you like dust. Following the farms, houses the color of old women, you gather a cargo from yards full of lapsed appliances, tin cans, crockery, snapped wheels, weedy, bottomless chairs. These float through the air to rest on the sleek hood, the clean seats. Things broken out of their forms move to you, their owner, their own. You slow under weight. The windshield blurs with the wingbeat of chickens. The hound's voice takes over your horn. A green glass vase from a grave in a field, comes flowerless to your hand, holds a smell of struck matches, of summer on rust, of running water, of rabbits, of home. Then the one place flung up like a barrier, the place where you stop, the last courthouse and gathering of garrulous stores. You have brought the town. It walks in your skin like a visitor. Here, under the wooden tongue of the church, by the paths with their toothed gates, in the light of the drunk as he burns, past hunkered children reaching for the eyes of their fathers, these fading and coming like seasons, you are the tall rooms of your dead. Merchants still ring small, furious bells, and the window of the movie house opens, and the girls who will open. Men still stand jackknifed to trace deer trails in the dirt, and blacks scythe the lawns, not singing, keeping their flag hidden. You may house again these weathers worn thin as coins that won't spend, worn smooth as the years between two who are old and not fooled any longer. You may stand beneath the cafe's blue sign where it steps on the face like a fly. You may bend to finger the cracked sidewalk, the shape of stilled lightning. Every fork, the same as it was when you thought that map led to the rim of the world. You may listen for thunder.
It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. That was Betty Adcock reading a poem entitled Southbound. Betty Adcock is part of a new anthology featuring the work of 15 contemporary North Carolina poets. The editor of this collection is Michael McPhee. Michael, welcome back to the National Humanities Center. How are you doing these days?
Thanks, Wayne. It's good to be back.
Well, congratulations on this wonderful new collection. Tell me about this title, The Language They Speak is Things to Eat.
That is a line from a poem by Jim Applewhite of Duke called Some Words for Fall, and he is talking about the way the people in Eastern North Carolina tobacco country speak, especially for someone who's been away for a while and goes back and listens to them. And he says, the language they speak is things to eat. And I thought that was a good title for this book because that was my point in the book, is that the language these poets speak isn't something esoteric and difficult. It's things to eat.
Tell me about poetry in North Carolina. We need to understand the rationale behind this collection. You are making the case for the strength, the vibrancy of poetry in the Tar Heel State. How about it?
Yes, indeed. It's very vigorous, as I hope these poems show. The last anthology, there have been a number of anthologies like this dating back to the 1850s. But the last one was done almost 20 years ago, and the poetry written since the late 70s is outstanding. All the poets in this book have won all the major prizes going and have published wonderful books. So when UNC Press published a book called The Rough Road Home a few years back, a collection of North Carolina short stories, contemporary North Carolina short stories.
That's Robert Ginger over at UNC.
Bob Ginger did that book, and I called up the press and said, this is swell that you guys are doing this, but you need a companion volume in poetry. And David Perry said, you're right. Do you want to do it?
Sure.
And I said, okay.
What do North Carolina poets have to say? What do they write about? What kinds of themes do they draw on? And what is, in fact, the language they speak?
Well, it's not that they write about North Carolina only, the landscape and the people and the stories of the state, though a lot of them do. But I think they do have more interest in story, in image, in wit, and sense of humor than perhaps poets in other parts of the country do. And I think that's what makes this book more accessible in a good way. I know accessibility is sometimes seen as pandering. It's really not the case in these poems. I think they're very entertaining and very sharp and could be read by anyone that likes to read.
What about attachment to place? You make the argument in your explanation, your little biographical sketches of these 15 contemporary North Carolina poets that they are all deeply tied. They may not have been born here. In fact, some of them don't even live here anymore, but they have strong connections to the soil of North Carolina. How about it?
They do, and it's a somewhat mysterious thing. Those who, for example, like Robert Morgan, were born here and raised here, but he's lived in Ithaca for over 20 years, and yet he writes almost constantly in his poems about North Carolina. And I think that's typical of people who have been here for a while. There's something about it that seeps into their consciousness and into their language and into their poems. In a way that that seems to me different from any other place I've ever lived or ever seen.
Is there a way to characterize the concerns of Tar Heel poets? I mean, my goodness, we run the gamut in this collection from the microscopic and what I suppose a critic might say is the trivialities of human existence, all the way up to these very large, cosmic, and typically poetic kinds of themes. What is it that brings them together? Anything at all?
Well, no. I don't think there's a house style or a house subject. The convenient thing is that there is North Carolina to bring them together. That's the whole hook for this book. But I think it's typical of the poems in this book and of contemporary poetry in general is that they focus on a particular scene or detail and don't necessarily step back from that and explain the larger issues involved, but let those details embody the issues of memory, of aging, of dying. Those are all in here.
Here you've raised some very large terms, as you say, living and dying and memory. I want to be a little contentious with you. What is the function of poetry in our society? Are poets and poetry supposed to do something to us to improve our lives, or how do you think of a question like that?
Well, I think it would be lovely if they could and did, but in America they don't, at least. All they can do is try to get something right in language and hope that somebody's going to read it or hear it and that it will engage them in some way and maybe change their life in a small way, and maybe a series of these small changes can add up to a large change. But poetry in this book and in America in general doesn't tend to be political, for example, or more philosophical or didactic.
Is it moral? Is it ethical? There is a movement abroad in our country which says that great literature should do something to us to improve the way we live and make us a better people and, you know, improve our civic discourse. Do you buy that argument,
oh,
Michael?
It's deeply moral. It is actually, I think, moral. But I think, again, in a quiet and understated way and not in a way that forces the morality on you. I think almost any poet from this book would make Senator Helms quite happy. If he would take time and look at them and look at the values and the things that they embody. But no, they don't. They, again, don't step back and preach that action.
Well, I wasn't thinking of Senator Helms so much as I was thinking of the complaint from parents and, you know, the sort of everyday person on the street who says, wait a minute, you know, poetry is a kind of luxury. You know, what's the big deal here? Let's get on with the our commercial capital society. You run into people like this,
oh,
critics
sure.
like that?
Oh, sure.
What do you say to them?
Well, I say that poetry is unlike what's going on in most of our culture. That is true. But what I like about it is that it slows you down. It makes you focus. It makes you take time to think about language and meaning and the things that poetry does, like nothing else. I mean, not even a video can do what a poem does.
Well, now you understand, Michael, that I'm arguing with you here for the sake of argument. I am your advocate, and I love talking about things like this. Let's have another example from The Language They Speak Is Things to Eat. This is your collection of 15 contemporary North Carolina poets.
Here are two very short poems by Fred Chappell of Greensboro, two epigrams, if you will, from his book of epigrams called Sea. This poem is called Televangelist. He claims that he'll reign equally with Jesus in eternity, but it's not like him to be willing to give a partner equal billing. And here's another one called El Perfecto. Senator No sets up as referee of everything we read and think and see. His justification for such stiff decreeing is being born a perfect human being, without a jot of blemish, taint, or flaw, the Dixie embodiment of moral law, quite fit and eager to pursue the quarrel with God, whose handiwork he finds immoral.
Michael McPhee, you've just read us a couple of poems here from your collection by Fred Chappell, the Greensboro poet. If I didn't know better, I'd say that you were going after, what shall we call them, American middle-class values?
No, he's going after misplaced American middle-class values, as in a televangelist who exploits his viewers and his listeners for the wrong purposes, or in as in a senator who Fred thinks might be doing the same thing with his constituents. So, no, not at all.
And poetry, you tell me, is not political?
This is very political poetry. this is a whole book of very funny, very political poems that Fred did, and I was delighted to have them in here, especially since they show, a lot of people say, well, contemporary poetry doesn't rhyme, it doesn't scan. These are very strictly rhymed and strictly metrical poems. But why not? Why can't we have that as well as the free verse poems, as
Fair
well
enough.
As other forms?
Well, that brings us to another area that comes up, another subject that comes up in your collection of 15 contemporary North Carolina poets, and that is a devotion to traditional kinds of poetry. That is to say, we look at it and we say, well, this rhymes, therefore it's a poem, or it follows a particular metrical pattern. Talk to me for a minute, Michael, about how devoted or undevoted these poets are to all of that literary sort of aesthetic stuff.
Right. I think they're certainly aware of the tradition, which involves matters of form and of rhyme and of meter. And in fact, a number of these poets use it even when you're not quite aware of it. If you look at Robert Morgan's poems, for example, he does some astonishing forms that, were you not reading it thinking I'm looking for forms, you wouldn't even realize he's doing it, which to me is the highest tribute to a poet.
Yeah, you talk about he uses sort of arcane French forms.
He does this poem in a form called the Chant Royal or Chant Royal, I guess. That's this extremely intricate French verse form, and he does it so skillfully that you're not even aware he's doing it until you get through. So these poets are very interested in form, but they also write the free verse that's more orthodox, I guess, these days.
Well, I want to turn to some of your poetry, Michael McPhee, and let's begin that part of the conversation with this question. How much do you follow all of that aesthetic and formal stuff? Which, as it were, comes first for you, the idea, the germ of the poem, or the goal of imitating another poet or fitting what you're thinking about into a particular structural kind of pattern?
For me, Wayne, the first thing is the image. It's the image. I guess it could be an idea, the hook, something that catches my eye or my ear or my mind that I have to jot down on a piece of paper and carry around and let it gestate in my pocket for a while.
So
and
you do live in the real world. You have little yellow stickies that you...
Oh, absolutely.
See, poets are supposed to be off there in the ivory tower.
Well, perhaps some of them are, but I'm not. And I can't imagine living that way because the world is too interesting to live away from all that. So, I take those images to the writing desk and work with them. And then as the poem is developing, maybe I'll say, well, look, this is taking on the shape of a sonnet, and maybe it would be best in that form. But I rarely think about imposing that on the material from the beginning.
How does poetry happen to you, Michael? Does it happen to you every day? Does it happen to you every hour? Do poems, you're walking down the street and you say, oh my goodness, there's a poem right there. Or how does all that work?
Well, that does happen, and that's wonderful when it does. like anyone else, Wayne, I have a job and I have to work, so I can't claim that poetry is happening every hour, even every day. I wish it did. I wish I had time for that. But if I had the time to be alert to what is going on around me, sure, it would be. And I would be jotting it down or memorizing it. Or, what, for example, in the car driving over here to tape this show, I keep a raft of Hardee's napkins in the drawer in the door beside me so that if I see something that catches my eye, I can pull out a napkin and jot it down. And on my way over here, sure enough, I saw a sign that I can't remember right now what it was, but I wrote it down. Maybe it'll turn up in a poem someday. Mm-hmm.
Well, I have yet to see the poem. What is it that you look in the rearview mirror? It says, things are closer or farther away than they appear. Somebody's written a poem like that, right?
Yeah, Heather Ross Miller, in fact, wrote it. She's in this anthology, though that poem is not in this book, but objects in mirror are closer than they appear.
There you go. There you go. One quick question before we turn to some of your poetry, Michael. I want you to tell our listeners how you became a poet. Born up in the mountains of North Carolina, and as a kid, for example, one of your poems is called First Radio. I don't know if that led to poetry, but all of that gestation as a poet. Can you summarize it for me quickly?
Well, I didn't set out to be a poet. I set out to be an architect and study that in college, but eventually took a creative writing class, and something clicked in that class and satisfied me in a way that architecture didn't. And the way I became a poet was I kept at it, Wayne. You know, there are points where I could have fallen off and become a librarian or become an editor, and the thing that held my attention was poetry, so I started trying to figure out a way to make a living at it, and it's ended up by being a teacher and having those summers off to write and having those days off during the week to write now and then, so... I didn't plan to be a poet. Nope, sure didn't. But I am, and I'm delighted to be one.
Well, I'd like you to read one of your poems, Michael. Let me invite you to read for us. Here's a poem called First Radio. I mean, I'm displaying my prejudices here, but I want to hear this.
This is a poem about the first transistor radio I ever owned back in the late 1950s. It's called First Radio. A plastic transistor from Japan, aqua with black vinyl straps, some chrome trim, an ear-sized speaker, dials like nails, perfect in the pocket as a pack of cigarettes, its hidden heart pulsing over mine. At lunch, at recess, on the bus, each fall I'd strain to crack the glamorous code of the World Series, pinching bright flags of foil around the bent antenna, hoping to attract Mantle or Koufax or Gibson. And at night, planting it under my pillow like a tooth, like a magic seed, I'd fall asleep to Top 40 big city DJs bouncing off cloud cover thousands of miles away. Better than any answered prayer.
Well, Michael, I will not argue with you that radio is indeed a poetic sort of enterprise here. How did this poem come about? Did it happen to you quickly? Was it a series of recovering your memory of your little boyhood and your first radio?
I was writing a series of poems about based on my childhood, not because my childhood was so unique, but because I thought it was like everyone else's. I mean, you and I have talked about this with this particular poem.
Sure.
And I discovered that I still had that radio from my childhood and started looking at it, and suddenly I realized there was this story in it about growing up way out in the mountains of North Carolina, feeling like you're in the middle of nowhere, and yet you have this little machine that could pull in the big world out there, WOWO, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Big WOWO.
Whoa. You know, and I was supposed to be in my bed saying my prayers like any good Baptist boy. What I was doing was listening to rock and roll under my pillow. So It was a powerful tool for connection to the larger world.
Well, speaking of your Baptist youth, you've got another poem in this collection, and that's called Backwards Through the Baptist Hymnal. You dedicate this to a fellow writer, Annie Dillard, and to your spouse, Belinda. Will you please, Michael McPhee, read this poem for us?
This poem was triggered by Annie's visit to Chapel Hill about 10 years ago when we took her back to her apartment where she was staying and saw that she had one of those hokey Hammond organs. And it led to this poem called Backwards Through the Baptist Hymnal. What glorious fossils from the faulty brain, impressed by rote in remote sanctuaries or around more distant campfires? What relics hauled Protestant into our killing air to demonstrate the double miracle, memory and song? What swarm of cicadas, dormant for 17 years, rising to plague the equinox with, is your all on the altar? Throw out the lifeline. Low in the grave he lay. At Calvary, blessed assurance, he lives. From the least scrap, whole hymns accumulate, words, melodic skeletons, ghostly descants. B plies the organ with its comic stops. Annie gravely brays the melody, while I go fishing for that plain bass line, surfacing during refrains to croak, send the light, I surrender all, it is well, by and by. We backslide through the low church standards, proclaiming an unreformed text, plenty of sin and saving blood, no hootenanny gospel yet. This may seem a joke to late chore neighbors, to God, even to us when I accidentally mash the swing key when the roll is called up yonder. It may be an offense against honest silence. But what could possibly be better than writing something to be read and sung until finally anonymous, licked smooth by the flock? Something turned to so often the page is finger-stained. Something, however flawed, that may, one night, suddenly come to other tongues as praise.
Michael McPhee, you've just read to us here Backwards Through the Baptist Hymnal. I think this poem is a wonderful case for the fact that poetry is, in fact, a spiritual kind of thing. There is a religious dimension here that is strong and vital. But you're not necessarily preaching a particular line, are you?
Not at all. In fact, it's just a story, basically, about this night we spent with Annie Dillard singing hymns in Chapel Hill, which seemed like an unlikely thing to do. But it was so much fun because we were all recovering parts of our past. You know, my wife and I grew up in different Southern Baptist churches. Annie encountered these hymns coming to camp in the South from the North. She grew up in Pittsburgh, but she was shipped out to camp in Virginia every summer, and that's where she learned these hymns. So we were all sharing in something that we'd had a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Michael, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Again, your anthology is The Language They Speak is Things to Eat, 15 Contemporary North Carolina Poets. How is poetry doing in our schools? You are a teacher of poetry. Is it a healthy enterprise there?
At the university level, it's doing extremely well. I teach over at Chapel Hill, and at Carolina, I've never had better student poets, and they seem better prepared to deal with poetry. So something good must be going on at the high school level as well. I mean, of course, they always have things to learn, and that's why I'm there to help them learn them. But it seems to me that the state of poetry is real vigorous right now, Wayne, and I'm delighted by that.
Widening the focus a little bit, you have the same sense about what's going on the poetic enterprise nationally. I remember talking to Adrienne Rich, who said it's never been stronger. I mean, more poetry reading groups. Mm-hmm. And yet there's a paradox. It isn't somehow visible in our culture. What about that?
Well, I think there's no one poet or no one school of poets that's dominating the scene. There's not a Robert Frost that's up there at the top and everyone else is way below him, or Lowell.
We did have Maya Angelou read at President Clinton's.
It was a very visible moment for poetry, as I say, and good for that. I think that's grand. But in general, the scene is much more diffuse and scattered. It's much more the democracy of poets that Whitman talked about. And to me, I think that's great. I think it's very healthy that you don't have to live in New York City to be a poet anymore. You can live right here in North Carolina or heaven knows any other place in the country and get good instruction in it, have a good poetry group to talk with your poems about and to work on your own.
It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest was Michael McPhee. We conclude with another reading by one of the writers in his collection of 15 contemporary North Carolina poets. Here again is Betty Adcock.
This is a poem titled remembering brushing my grandmother's hair. I see her in a ring of sewing, light fingers on needle and hoop, elaborate scissors shaped like a tiny stork, the glass egg in her lap. Her temperate morning wore black shoes. Released, her hair released a scent as I imagined of ascending birds or smoke from a burning without source, but cool as mist over a real country, altars in the hills. That gray reached all the way to the floor. A cloak, wind in a cloak, her hair in my hands crackled and flew. I dreamed her, young and flying from some tallest room before she had to let her power down for something to take hold and climb. Permanence. Rose and vine were twisted hard in silver on the brush and mirror. Above us, the accurate clock pinged. Always on a time there comes a sleep, stony as a tower with the wild world beneath. And wound like this with locked bloom tarnishing. I brushed, she sewed or dozed. The child I was stood shoulder deep in dying, in a dress of falling silver smoothed by silver, of forgetfulness dimming the trees outside the window like a rain. To grow, to stay, to braid and bend from one high window. I guessed the story I would learn by heart, how women's hands among sharp instruments learn sleep, the frieze like metal darkening, the land sown deep with salt.
Poet Betty Adcock. She's part of a new anthology of 15 contemporary North Carolina poets. The collection is entitled The Language They Speak Is Things to Eat, edited by Michael McPhee and available from the University of North Carolina Press. Betty Adcock's new book of poems, The Difficult Wheel, will be published this fall by Louisiana State University Press. Michael McPhee's new collection of verse, Colander, is scheduled for publication early next year by Carnegie Mellon University Press. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Audio cassettes of this program are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 777. That's program number 777. The address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code again, 27709. Next week on Soundings, one of America's distinguished musicians. Join me for conversation and a musical excerpt featuring composer T.J. Anderson. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. The language they speak is things to eat. This week on Soundings, I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for readings and conversation with poet Michael McPhee. His new book brings together the work of 15 contemporary North Carolina poets. The Tar Heel State has long enjoyed a reputation for its nationally known writers of fiction, and now their poetic counterparts are joining the ranks. The language they speak is things to eat, an overview of poetry in contemporary North Carolina, this week on Soundings.